My name is Meera Kaimal, and I'm here with Anjana Nagarajan Bhutani. And today we are talking to Bill DeVincenzi, a Bay Area climate change activist, for our climate change series, Our Climate is Changing, Why Aren't We? Bill lives in San Jose and has a pretty incredible background. Bill, you were a CFO, you taught for 25 years at San Jose State, and you also serve on several nonprofit boards. And in addition to all of this, you're a trained climate reality activist. You say you've retired for the third time, but you are committing to the most vital issue of our time, which is climate change. Welcome to Desi Collective, Bill.
Thank you, Meera, and I am very honored and excited to come out of retirement for the third time and take on what I consider to be the, and what a lot of people consider to be the existential threat of our time, which is the climate crisis.
And joining us today is Erin Zimmerman, who is our friend and collaborator, and also a climate reality leader who's working with us at Desi Collective to find ways to educate and inspire our community about climate change. Hi, Erin, it's great to have you back.
It's always a pleasure, ladies.
So today, Bill and Erin are going to talk to us about tipping points. We're going to find out what happens when ice caps melt, forests die, and permafrost thaws, and microbes multiply. And these events result in runaway climate change. Scientists say that some of these changes are irreversible, and the world is at a tipping point. So let's get started. Bill, tipping points are also called feedback loops. Can you explain what they are and how they work, and why humans are responsible?
Sure. A feedback loop is just simply a series of self-perpetuating events, okay, that keep themselves going. Some of the examples we'll talk about later, you know, that global warming, you know, will cause permafrost to melt, which will release greenhouse gases, which will cause more global warming, which will cause permafrost to melt more. And it just, it kind of continues in this serious loop. A tipping point is when that feedback loop gets to the point where it becomes irreversible. And then you have runaway climate change.
Yeah, it's sort of like a tipping point is you've got a train and it's going in a direction, and the tipping point determines what direction it's going in, and the feedback loops accelerate the train. So yeah, one is a turn and the other one is the faster it goes. It's like a vicious cycle.
Scientists say we only have 10 years, and basically what they're saying is certain of those tipping points, you know, because these feedback loops are in existence right now. They're happening, okay? But we have maybe 10 years before some of those feedback loops hit that tipping point and become irreversible.
Yeah, and they also become exponential. Is that right, Bill? They become exponential. So it's not just they only get gradually worse. They will become significantly worse. It's very similar to, well, we all know how a virus acts. A lot of these feedback loops are going to be the same thing. It's not going to get twice as bad. It's going to get exponentially worse if these sort of feedback loops get started.
Well, one worst case scenario could be that as the earth warms and the ice melts and the exposes the open ocean, what happens there is that you're losing sea ice, which is the best reflector of sunlight, and turning it into ocean, which is the worst absorber of sunlight. When you reach that tipping point where you've exhausted a critical amount of your sea ice, there's no coming back unless we get into the next ice age, you know, 10,000 years from now. There's just no coming back from that.
I understand that we need greenhouse gases to regulate the Earth's temperature, protects us from radiation, but the actions of human beings are responsible for producing too much of these gases like carbon dioxide and methane. Why is this happening and what is the impact?
Well, first of all, why it's happening is because since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, human beings have been burning more and more fossil fuel like coal, gas, and oil. And the impact of burning all of that fossil fuel is that we have put more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than we've had in the last 800,000 years. The problem with that is that the Earth's temperature follows lockstep with that increase and decrease in carbon dioxide. Right now, we're in this period where the CO2 has gone way up and the temperature has not quite responded yet because there's this little time lag, right? Which we're lucky, but it will go up. It will follow it up. And if it gets as hot as where that CO2 level is right now, we're all gone. Okay. Two things need to happen. One, we have to stop putting CO2 into the atmosphere. And two, we need to start taking some of that CO2 that's already up there out. Every bit of CO2 we've ever put up there since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution is still there. It stays in the atmosphere for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. It just does not come down. So it's like a bathtub. It's full of water. We can't put any water in there. And somebody needs to start draining that tub. And that's a good analogy to think about it.
Does that mean that too much CO2 in the atmosphere is killing the planet as we know it?
I wouldn't say it's killing the planet. The planet has existed through five mass extinctions in the past. The planet will survive just fine. The problem is, will human beings survive? You know, what we're doing continues.
Yeah, I always laugh when people say I'm saving the planet, and I'm like, oh, it's much more self-interested than that. You are saving right. yourself. Mm-hmm. And there is a book out called The Sixth Extinction, which I think was actually recommended by some Ivy League colleges for all their freshman students to read. And it talks specifically about how the first five extinctions were caused by meteors or massive environmental and ecological die-offs. But none of them have happened as quickly as what we're calling the sixth extinction, which is the one that we're currently in right now. And Bill can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we've lost like 40% of our land species since the 1970s. And it's we're in the Anthropocene, which is the only, of course, era named after people. And it's because we are the only sort of creatures on the planet who have ever had the ability to directly impact weather, not just, and climate, not just weather. And we are actually the cause, and we're living through, or I should say we are living in the sixth extinction. And I think our actions right now will determine whether or not we live through that sixth extinction.
Let's get into a little bit more detail about the four major feedback loops that are escalating the crisis. The forests are dying, the permafrost is melting, the atmosphere is filling with toxins, and the ice caps are breaking up. So our forests are dying, or the truth is we humans are killing our forests. How is this happening, and what's the impact to life on the planet?
Okay, well, the feedback loop kind of goes like this. So as we burn more and more fossil fuel, we release more greenhouse gases. As we release more greenhouse gases, the planet warms. And as the planet warms, we get a hotter, drier climate. A hotter, drier climate results in more droughts, more fires, and more insects that kind of like that kind of temperature. And so as the trees die and burn, they release carbon dioxide, and they turn from a carbon sink into a carbon source, so to speak, and they release more CO2 and methane into the atmosphere, which increases the amount of greenhouse gases, which causes the planet to warm, which causes drier climates, and here we go. We are involved in a feedback loop.
I think we all saw the evidence of that in September of last year when California was facing all those fires. And the California fire season has lengthened by 75 days since the 1980s. And so it's almost 3 months longer than it used to be, which is just sort of a mind-boggling concept. And it's just because it's drier for longer and all of these trees are getting just baked in the sun and the heat, and then they die off. And then of course, when the fire sparks, you get things like you got last September. And the pests is another thing. And I'm not sure how bad it is in California, but I'm from Colorado. Originally. And in the Rockies, we've got the pine beetle. And the pine beetle used to die off every year with a hard freeze. A good hard freeze would kill a lot of the pine beetle. And so it was a pest that was sort of manageable as long as the weather stayed the same. But now we've had, the winters just aren't as cold, and they don't get cold enough to kill off the pine beetle. And now as you drive into, you know, Rocky Mountain National Park, you just see swaths of dead pine trees everywhere. And that combined with additional heat and less rain means that when we get these fires, and Colorado had a massive record-breaking fire year last year as well, the mountains are just filled with tinder. Once these forests are gone, getting them back, particularly now that we have less rain and more heat, is going to be almost impossible.
We have three types of forests. We have the tropical, the boreal, and what we're talking about right now are the temporal. You know, these older forests store a lot of CO2. And we need to do everything we can to preserve these forests. Logging, you know, they're burning wood chips that they make, and that results in about 17% of CO2 release. So we can't afford to allow these forests to die or for logging to continue to deforest. Tropical forests like the Amazon is like 2 million square miles of forest. The rainforest is kind of self-perpetuating in itself. It creates its own rain. You know, that's why it's called the rainforest. If those trees die, there's no more rain. And when that happens, it turns into savanna and you don't get another rainforest back. So that becomes one of those irreversible feedback loops that we just can't afford to let happen. You know, it's very close to releasing more CO2 than it absorbed, because 20% of it's been destroyed in recent years for farming and for fires and what have you. And tropical forests now are emitting roughly a third less CO2 than they did in the 1990s. So scientists are saying that the Amazon could flip in the next decade. It is close to its tipping point. The third is the boreal, or the forest up in the north, in the far north. Two thirds of all of our carbon is stored in those forests. And again, they've been experiencing significant fires. So all of the forests are threatened, and we really, 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 really need to work on stopping deforestation and regreening the planet, basically.
You're also saying something about plant life moving north. What does that mean?
So the temperatures are literally warming as we move north, right? In fact, the North Pole, that the Arctic region, I should say, is warming 2 to 3 times faster than the rest of the planet. As that area gets warmer, now trees and vegetation that were typical to the middle of the hemisphere are now moving north because it's warmer and they can survive there.
Let's go from forest fires to frost. What happens when permafrost thaws, and why is it dangerous? Can you give us an example of the damage it's causing?
I would say millions of years ago and prior to the last ice age, you know, 10, 15,000 years ago, there used to be a lot more vegetation. And when the earth cooled the ice age, it covered a lot of organic material with ice, okay? And so that organic material is now buried in the ice and is called permafrost. And so when that permafrost melts, it exposes all that organic material, and that material immediately begins to decompose. And nature's natural process of decomposition is microbes, which eat the decomposing material and releases that noxious smell we all smell when we go by a dump called methane.
Yeah, and methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas than we always talk about carbon dioxide. That's what people think about. But methane is many, many times worse.
It's like 30 times worse
than carbon dioxide. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In trapping heat, it accelerates it that much more quickly.
Although methane, you know, is relatively short-lived. It's only up there for a couple hundred years. And so, to me, that's a long time. Whereas CO2 can be up there for many thousands of years. So there's a difference there, which is why the CO2 is a problem and will be a problem until we figure out a way to get it down.
So let's talk clouds. What role do clouds play in protecting our climate, and how are clouds affected by global warming?
Well, as you can imagine, as the feedback loop is, as you get a warmer ocean, you get more evaporation, and more evaporation releases water vapor into the atmosphere. Water vapor is a heat-trapping gas, just like methane and carbon dioxide. But water vapor that condenses becomes clouds. A cloud, because it's white, reflects sunlight. So theoretically, it should protect the planet from getting too warm. But clouds also are like a blanket, and any heat down below stays there. Scientists haven't really kind of agreed on whether they're better or worse. The clouds are kind of, I would say, neutral, but the problem is really the water vapor that is caused by the increased wetness in the atmosphere, like what Aaron was talking about with the hurricanes.
Yeah, the humidity causes more hurricanes and so on.
Humidity makes the hurricanes a lot worse, and it's the same thing here.
Anyone who's lived in a place where it snows, you know that the nights where if it's snow on the ground and it's crystal clear outside, you know it's going to be freezing cold. But if it's a cloudy night, it's actually usually not that cold outside. That's the effect we're talking about.
You were talking earlier, Erin, about hurricanes, and you said that there were so many of them that the weathermen ran out of names for them.
Yeah, the hurricanes are going to be more frequent and get worse as climate change continues, because the ocean absorbs 93% of all the heat that comes from the sun. And the hotter it is, every degree the water is warmer, it can carry, 8% more moisture. And the more moisture a hurricane has, it's that much stronger. And so this past year, we had so many hurricanes they normally go through names, they're all women 1 year, they're all men 1 year. They ran out of names, and they ran out of names relatively quickly. And so they actually switched over to the Greek alphabet. And then I think they ran out of the Greek alphabet.
No, not quite. Basically, they used 21 letters out of the 26 in our alphabet. And then when they're exhausted, they start. So they got nine deep into the Greek alphabet.
Greek alphabet, because they just didn't.
Iota was the last one. Yeah.
They didn't expect that many. And this is, everyone talks about, it's a once in a 500 year event or once in a 1,000 year event. But it's not. Like, when we say it's extreme weather, it's more like now it's weather. This isn't a one-off. It's just sort of going to be what we have to get used to. So I guess we're going to have to come up with more names or get more creative, because we can expect this to continue on in the future.
It's not going to get better. I mean, the last record year was, 3 or 4 years ago, they had 25 named storms. Last year, this 2020, they had 30 named storms. Mm-hmm. So that's the record. So it's not like, it's every 500. No, this is the highest it's ever been.
Yeah.
And this is just the Atlantic, right?
Yeah, I don't think it covers the Pacific.
Yeah. Pacific, they call them typhoons.
Typhoons, yeah.
Right. And then what happens in places like Bangladesh?
Bangladesh is in a really unfortunate situation. It's a very low-lying country. And I think something like 80% of Bangladesh is within 5 meters of sea level. So as the sea level rises, which it will do as sea ice melts and water, as it warms up, expands. So we can expect this to start rising up. As that happens, we're going to see, obviously, sea level rise is going to push inward. King tides are going to be much more devastating as they go further inland. Hurricanes are going to be much more devastating. And Bangladesh has been unfortunately hit by several very strong hurricanes in the last few years. But the worrying thing is also that long before sea level rise takes over the land, people aren't going to be able to live on it, because they're not going to have access to fresh water. The fresh water resources are going to be spoiled by the salt water intruding. And, salt water going over the land is going to make it so it's not possible for farming. And Bangladesh is very populous. I believe it's got something like 80 million people. Yeah. And these people are going to have to go somewhere. And we can expect, I think it's somewhere around 100 million climate refugees by 2100. And these people have to go somewhere, and most often it's going to be into other countries facing similar problems that will just exasperate additionally fragile infrastructures. And the concept of climate conflict is very real and very likely to be a much more noticeable sort of influence in politics in the next, I would say, even 5-10 years.
Let's talk about the jet stream and what it is and how it impacts our lives. Can you explain, for instance, how the wildfires in California are tied to the swings of the jet stream?
The jet stream, basically, there's a weather pattern that kind of circles around the north. Sometimes they call it the polar vortex. If everything goes according to normal, the jet stream kind of circles around, and it's formed by the difference between the extreme cold in the north and the warmth in the south. It kind of holds this thing in place as it continues to swirl around. Well, as the north warms, all of a sudden that jet stream, it starts to misbehave. It doesn't just stay up in the north. It starts to wander around. And in fact, it got so far south this time that that's what was happening in Texas just recently, that the jet stream came in a loop all the way down and caused some bitter cold in Texas. It also takes some of that warmer air with it and mixes and brings it back up north again. So now you've got this feedback loop, right, where the jet stream is, because it's weakened, because it's warmer in the north, is venturing further south. It's picking up more warm air as it travels and goes back up and makes it even warmer in the north. So that's kind of in a nutshell what the jet stream is doing. Because we're not getting that cold air coming down as much from the north, it allows higher pressure systems to build off the coast of California. And so we've been experiencing extreme drought now for the last, it's been a while. I mean, from 2011 through about 2014 or 15, we had extreme drought situations. And now here we are again.
Yeah, the jet stream is, it's essentially, people get used to what we call normal weather. It's destabilizing existing weather patterns. Occasionally you get the polar vortex, which is actually when the jet stream splits. It's when hot air from Asia actually goes up to the North Pole and pushes down the jet stream on either side. So they actually had a 100-degree day in Siberia last year. It actually got over 100 degrees for the first time ever in recorded history. And what happens is it pushes the cold air down, which is why you get these really weird spots of cold air down in the south. And then it's actually warm further north, which, you know, is not only is it just like weird and is unusual, but it's really, it's traumatic for the animals and plant life that is sort of acclimated to these things. And it also creates sort of severe weather that people aren't expecting. I mean, obviously people in Texas were not prepared for snow. And then you also get the extreme cold up in places like, you know, Wisconsin and Michigan. And that's where you end up with these huge polar vortex blizzards, or when I think, you know, it was so cold in Chicago that you couldn't go outside. And I was living in Madison at the time of a polar vortex, and it was 1 degree warmer than the surface of Mars. So that's kind of what happens during this polar vortex. So it's not just like odd weather, it's like extreme weather that messes with, you know, the way people are used to it. And we can't adapt to that. Our crops can't adapt to that. You know, our infrastructure can't adapt to that. So we say, oh, so the weather's changing, but we don't realize how dependent we are on the weather until you realize that we can't function when it's changed out of what we're expecting.
My niece Lisa lives just outside of Chicago, and was it 2 years ago, I think, when the polar vortex came down? She said they couldn't go out of the house for 3 days because it hurt to breathe. You know, we're having unusual weather, but it's happening more frequently. And I think that's
it's not even unusual anymore. It's just weather. Right. And I know the same thing happens with the heat. You know, you get the crazy heat in the summer, and thousands of people actually die during these surges of heat. I know they certainly do across India. I believe it was 2 summers ago, because there was a drought and then this oppressive heat, and it was just like people can't live when it's, I think it was 114 degrees or something in some place. It's not amenable to life in certain places. And we just had the hottest recorded temperature ever on planet Earth in Death Valley this last year. Yeah, it's happening.
Talking about the wildfires in California, this last year was the worst fire season ever. Over 4 million acres burned. The previous record was 1.7 million acres 2 years before. So, I mean, the jump was humongous because of the drought. You know, we're facing similar circumstances this year. So it's a kind of a scary thought. And one of those fires was burning just right up the hill from me here. And we had to evacuate our house.
Yeah, I felt like I was in Blade Runner. It didn't even it didn't even feel real. It looked like a post-apocalyptic landscape for a while. It was really disconcerting. And that, you know, there were times when you're outside and there's ash raining down on you from the forest fires. And the thing that got me was we'd surpassed the record for the most damage, the most acreage burnt before the official forest fire season actually started last year.
Yeah,
that was before the actual fire season.
Yeah, and all of us in the Bay Area didn't even know where to go because there was a fire in every direction.
Yeah, you were surrounded. Everyone's like, where are you going to go? And you're like, into the ocean? I think a lot of people, they hear about climate change, they know it's out there, but they think it's a peripheral. It's something that happens to other people, especially these major life-altering impacts like having to evacuate or losing your home. And I think last year it brought home to a lot of folks that I am just as vulnerable to these consequences as everybody else, which I think was actually a good thing. We have seen an uptick in people taking the topic seriously, realizing that it's an existential threat to everybody, not just to who they think, you know, who they see on TV.
I have one last question. The Arctic melt, what's happening in the Arctic? How does the ice melt there affect the rest of the planet?
Okay, well, again, the feedback loop kind of runs something like this. And again, they all start the same way. Burning of fossil fuels, emitting greenhouse gases, causes the global temperature to rise. Rising global temperatures cause the oceans to warm. And as the oceans warm more and more of the sea ice melts. And that results in more open ocean. So you have less reflective sea ice, which is the albedo effect. You have less reflectivity, and you have more heat being absorbed into the ocean. They're estimating that in the last 40 years, we've lost 75% of our sea ice. So sea ice reflects 85% of the sunlight that hits it. And I think, as Aaron mentioned, open ocean absorbs 93% of the sunlight that hits it. So you've just eliminated the greatest reflector of sunlight and replaced it with the greatest absorber of sunlight and heating. Again, as you hit a tipping point, if the Arctic ice covering has been there for 2.5 million years, if that melts completely, it's not coming back unless we have another ice age. And how it affects the rest of the planet, you know, is of course all that melting ice in the north and Greenland and in the south is causing oceans to rise. And as Aaron talked about what's happening with Bangladesh, that's going to happen in a lot more places around the world.
And I mean, we all saw the picture of that polar bear, the starving polar bear. It's just an indication that there's a whole ecosystem in the Arctic that's dependent on sea ice that will disappear. So it's not just an empty space that's cold. There's so many complicated factors into what will happen if we dilute the ocean. I was actually listening to a presentation where someone was mentioning real estate in Florida. And he said that they found out that, you know, where everyone wanted to live on the coast, and even though hurricanes were an issue, nobody really took it seriously. And like coastal property was like the hot ticket. And they've noticed now that the exact same house that's on the coast will now sell for 14% less than a house that's inland and uphill just a little bit, which is actually a very smart investment. There's absolutely no way I would buy any property on the coast right now, because the coast is going to be gone soon. Or closer to us, we've got Highway 1. And it's like every year, Highway 1 gets closed because they have to do repairs on it because it's eroding. And part of that erosion is caused by obviously more violent storms and sea level rise. And so, well, the Bay Area will still be here, but it will be much further inland than it used to be. A lot of these iconic things that define America to us are under threat from rising. Unfortunately, Washington, D.C. Was built in a swamp. And a lot of our, you know, a lot of our culture is also not impervious to the sea, because we like to think that we're masters of, you know, the environment, but you can't hold back the ocean.
So let me ask you, can we reverse a feedback loop?
Well, the answer to that is yes and no. If we can do something before the tipping point, then the answer is yes. But once you reach that tipping point, you know, if enough sea ice melts, it becomes irreversible. If enough of the Amazon forest is deforested and it turns into savanna, it's too late. So we have time right now, and that's why we say we have, you know, 9 or 10 years before some of these tipping points are reached. And we really need to focus on what we can do to make sure those tipping points don't get reached.
Yeah, I'd actually say we don't have time. We need to act now. Like it, you say, we have time, like, we can put it off for a couple of years. Okay, we have time to panic. We have time to be like, we need to get started now.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
So Bill, what do you think the takeaway should be for our listeners? How do we decarbonize?
Stop by using fossil fuel. You know, get yourself an electric or hybrid car. Transportation is one of the largest sources of fossil fuel burning. Going all electric in your house. Replace all of your gas burning appliances with electric. That would make a huge difference as well, because we have to stop using natural gas.
Yeah, and ensure that your electric comes from renewable resources, which you can easily do in the Bay Area.
Yeah, because we have the community choice energy in San Jose. It's San Jose Clean Energy. Anybody can do this, and that's a good point, Aaron, is they can go online, San Jose Clean Energy, and ask to switch to 100% renewable energy.
And so, it's about a dollar more expensive.
I've been keeping track of mine for the last 2 years, and it's like somewhere between $1 and $2. And that's going to go down, you know, as the cost of fossil fuel, as the cost of clean energy continues to go down, you know, that differential is going to go away. You know, we're talking about the cost of a cup of coffee a month, right? Yeah. To go to 100% clean energy, and anybody can do that.
Anywhere in the Bay Area, north and south, if you look up community choice energy, you should be able to find an option to switch to 100% renewables.
I've got
solar panels
on your roof. See, we work together well.
We do work together a lot.
I did that about a year ago now. So I've been generating my own electricity as well. So last and not least is use your voting power and your lobbying power to call your legislators and ask them to stop subsidizing the fossil fuel industry. Right now, the fossil fuel industry gets 37 times more funding than clean energy does. And we need to put a stop to that. And then you'll actually see and experience the difference between the low cost of clean energy versus the higher, much higher cost of fossil fuel.
So my last question for both of you, we are in a crisis, but not enough people are paying attention. Why do you think people don't listen?
I think they are listening. I think people are well aware of what is happening, but it's like analysis paralysis. It is such a big challenge to their fundamental way of life, how they live, that they think, I just can't deal with it, so I'm not going to.
My concern is, people who are denialists, it's really a cop-out. Because if you deny something, so that's not really a problem, then you don't have to do anything.
And I also think that it's a problem of collectivism. Like, we call it the tragedy of the commons. So if there's a common resource, people sort of are incentivized to use as much of that resource as they can so that other people don't use it, so they get the most benefit, but then that resource gets exhausted and then nobody can use it. And so the environment is like the quintessential commons. And right now we do not put a price on the commons. And that, I believe, I'm a political scientist by training, and that's the role of the government. The role of the government is to protect things and people that cannot protect themselves. And that includes the environment. So I feel like it's very important for people to reach out to their legislatures and be like, there is political will behind this. Yeah. And not just at the federal level, right? Your state legislature, if you know your people in your city, like I live in Sunnyvale and I have certainly showed up at city council meetings and asked them, what is our climate plan? And yeah. They're looking at you, you're face to face with these people, and you challenge them on this stance. And that is a very, very effective way to put this on their agenda. You can only control your own actions, but as a voting citizen or as someone who can get people to vote or influence voting citizens, your most important contribution will be your voice. And I love a Gandhi quote when we talk about things like this. We say like the measure of any society can be found in how it treats its most vulnerable members. And if you think about climate change, the people who suffer the most from climate change are the ones who had no contribution to creating it. It's going to be the developing countries, it's going to be the poor, it's going to be the people of color. And so it's a moral issue as much as it is an economic and social one. If you believe that it's our role to protect people who cannot protect themselves, then you have to take action on climate.
We were in conversation with climate change activists Bill DeVincenzi and Aaron Zimmerman. Thank you for clearing up so many misconceptions we have about the pace of climate change, and also how these changes that seem to be happening far away, whether in the Arctic or the Amazon, aren't quite so distant actually. Bill and Aaron, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, ladies.
This is Desi Collective with Anjana Nagarajan-Bhutani and Meera Kaimal. Tune in for our next episode of Our Climate is Changing, Why Aren't We? To learn how you can make a difference.